It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Starting in 2023, college athletes in California would be permitted to hire agents and make money on endorsements, all while still in college. The NCAA is already fighting it, but the move has sparked lawmakers in states, including Pennsylvania, to explore similar measures. Joining us on the line is attorney Ralph Sindrich, former star linebacker at the University of Pittsburgh, who played 4 years in the NFL. His law firm, Sindrich & Associates, represents sports clients. Ralph, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on. And I do want to say that I'm a resident of Pittsburgh and just staying out here so I'm able to see my granddaughters.
Well, I hope you enjoy them.
Thank you. I do.
What's your reaction to this first step by Governor Gavin Newsom of California to let college athletes profit off of their own talent and image?
You know, I think that's the reason why you have professional football and why you have an amateur status with the collegiate football players. I guess, you know, weighing all things and knowing what I know, I'm not for it. At least now you have some rules in place. Those rules are ignored, and it's really an open market out there. In other words, any agent or scumbag can go and approach these guys and offer them money, and they become pros then, except nobody knows. So they get approached early. They get money. It depends on the school and the way things are run.
But the colleges do make money off of their images, off of their shirts with their names and numbers on. Shouldn't players get some sort of compensation?
Sure. I don't have a problem with that. But aren't they getting compensation by going to college? I mean, it's a free education. I was blessed to be able to go, although I'm not sure by that time my folks could have paid, but I was blessed to be able to go to college on a football scholarship, or it could have been a wrestling scholarship. But it's the idea that I was able to screw around a lot instead of having extra jobs. Now I had to work out and do that stuff, but instead of having the extra job of going to work for $6 an hour.
So how do you think this would work if it goes through in California and possibly in other states? How many athletes do you think would actually get some compensation? How could they make that work?
If it's compensation for marketing, very few. Marketing means, you know, those guys that you see on TV and women that you see on TV endorsing products and doing stuff like that. There's just not a lot of that out there. I mean, that's a real hard sports dollar if someone's trying to make a living off of the professional athletes or athletes who become professional in that manner. I don't see this as a panacea for the players out there, that this is going to change anything. Maybe in basketball, where you have players that can become more of a celebrity, because of fewer players, that there you could have that, where I could see it benefiting the players to a large degree. Otherwise, I just don't see it unless you're going to start paying them just like you do in the NFL. And why call college and go with this joke of amateur status? It's not amateurism.
So maybe a couple stars on a basketball team, basically depending on how talented your team is, and maybe a couple on the football team, you know, the star quarterback, receiver, running back. So we're talking about a minimal number, do you think?
You know, I think what you're saying there is bingo. I mean, it's a touchdown. That's exactly what it comes down to.
Ralph, you personally have played under those NCAA rules as an athlete and also as an agent representing former college athletes. How much of a legal pushback do you think we might get from the NCAA on this?
Well, I think a lot. I mean, the NCAA is a big-time business, and really they control everything. They've had the politicians in their pocket for years and years. Now only are we seeing where individuals out there are protesting for the rights of athletes, I think some changes are probably on the horizon, although I don't think I'm necessarily for them.
You mentioned the NCAA, a pretty big organization. Could you see them going as far as maybe ostracizing California, not recognizing their sporting events, not televising ones they include, not even choosing cities there for tournaments and other events? Could they wield that kind of weight?
Yes, they can. I don't know that I would necessarily foresee that happening, but they are that type of organization. They have that type of strength, and they could throw that out there.
On the other hand, might this give schools in California a recruiting advantage, saying, hey, come to UCLA, USC, fill in the California school of your choice and say, you know, you could get a compensation for the jerseys we sell with your name on it. You could hire an agent or what have you.
Certainly, two naive collegiate or high school athletes and their families, I could see that happening. The fact of the matter is, particularly in, let's say, team sports like football, not basketball. There's too many in football to have the same type of attraction that basketball has. But there are very few players, let's say the NFL, and make it analogous to the collegiate football. Very few NFL players make any sizable income from marketing their image, their likeness. It's just a very hard dollar out there. It's not like paying someone. I would say an offensive left tackle who's one of your, you know, as you go into your offensive lines and offensive teams, one of your most valuable players on the team after quarterback and maybe another talented player or two, extremely important, but gets zero return for image or likeness out in the market.
What would you say to the argument, yes, these athletes are getting college scholarships, free rides to college, but a lot of these athletes do come from low-income families. Couldn't this help a few bucks, maybe more than a few, help them while they're in college, you know, to get a pizza, to go out on a date?
And I don't think there's any question that that is true. I saw it, witnessed it myself, and I think you can provide for that. You can make exceptions that aren't across the board. And it's I think most people, when they apply for aid or whatever else, they have to give up their income, their family's income, you know, all of those factors. And if they fall short of whatever standard is set up, why not then have the NCAA supplement their income? Because they would, in many cases, have to go out there and work. It would also help to clean up what goes on with the alumni out there, but not very much. The alumni are, in many places, are pigs in the sense of the amount of money that they throw out there just for the bottom line of winning and really without regard or care for anything else.
Duke Hall of Fame basketball coach Mike Krzyzewski has come out and saying he supports the California law. Do you think if more big name coaches take that tack, it actually could help if this is to move forward?
Yes, particularly in something like basketball, and I'm sure Mike has seen plenty of that himself and has had to do certain things to get players into his school. Is it a need out there? Certainly. I mean, there are a lot of people. You can go into my hometown, and almost anyone would qualify back in my area. So I think there's a qualification standard, and there's also the fact that, yeah, these guys are working. They're bringing name and whatever else to the university. Why shouldn't they be compensated? But the argument, counter-argument, is they're being compensated with a full education. So would I like to see it all the way across the board? No. Are there standards that you could put into place that would, in my view, make it acceptable to other athletes and most of the people out there? Yes. I mean, because you're providing benefits out there to one athlete, and if you're not providing them across the board, even if other ones don't have the same need, they're putting in the same time, effort, and everything else, and they're not getting paid. So I think potentially you have a problem there.
So to clarify, you would think that there could be some exceptions for some low-income athletes, some sort of criteria for determining that?
Absolutely, and why not? Although I will say in most of those cases, those guys are greased far more than other guys. Greased meaning some alumnus or booster coming in and just putting wads of cash in their pocket. You have all of that. It's not an honest system. I mean, you can't talk about it in a black and white circumstances. There's a lot of this that goes on out there, and it's something that either you try to eradicate or you maybe go into programs like this to where you implement it more on a legal basis than with the alumni. But you're still going to have the alumni come in, and they're going to want to get close to the athlete. They're going to give them money, take care of them, that type of thing. So I think it's going to be a full circle, but I'd still like to see it.
Pennsylvania State Representatives Ed Gainey and Dan Miller are introducing legislation in the state house, the Pennsylvania Fair Pay to Play Act. It would mirror California's law. Do you think more states would follow suit and saying, this might be a good idea? Would you be surprised if they did?
Yeah, I don't know. I think when you sit back and look at what California has done on a historical basis, you have to sit and just maybe hesitate a little bit more and ponder on what they're doing. Do I see other states doing that? If that becomes a competitive advantage, absolutely. Those schools that recruit heavily against some of those California schools, if you have to do that to play on a level field, yes, I see other states doing it also.
Final question. For years, off and on, there's been a debate, should we pay college athletes? And then, of course, it evolves to, is it just the revenue sports, football, basketball? Should it be all college athletes who get some sort of compensation from the university? Is allowing them to receive compensation for marketing at least a compromise in that debate?
I don't know. I'm torn on that. The players that I was around, and I was a scholarship athlete, all seem to have money from one source or another. And I guess I'm just not in favor of taking it to that stage. We have professional athletes. We have enough things to go on a professional basis. This is college. If you want to break it down into categories of students who are athletes and non-athletes and that, I just don't think that is a proper basis of being able to do it. I'm more old school on it. I'm sure you're going to get those out there who just say, go ahead and pay them. But from my point of view, if someone comes from middle class family or whatever, then they're getting a scholarship, that's good enough, and that monthly per diem, and then pick up wherever you can, from other sources. But I just think they're, when I've seen the players, if they have that type of need, I'm okay. I'm all for it. But they got to have that type of need, not across the board.
Ralph Sindridge is a former star linebacker at the University of Pittsburgh who played 4 years in the NFL and is a longtime sports agent and attorney. Ralph, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me on. Good talking with you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. A local man lost a job offer after failing a drug test due to his legal use of medical marijuana. Did the company violate medical marijuana law? And 1,500 unionized cleaners in Pittsburgh are bargaining for better wages and benefits. They'll stand with local and state leaders at a rally in the Strip District this afternoon. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us your suggestion at wesa.fm/confluence. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Lynyrd Skynyrd's 1977 album Street Survivors is the stuff of legends. Well, urban legends anyway. Released just 3 days prior to the deadly plane crash that took the lives of Steve Gaines and Ronnie Van Zant, Street Survivors shows the group engulfed in flames on the front cover, and songs like That Smell feature lyrics about the smell of death surrounding you. RCA recalled the original records and reissued the album with a plain black cover. It ended up reaching number 5 on the album charts in America. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
A plan to energize Pennsylvania's economy by capitalizing on natural gas development is falling flat with environmentalists. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Energize PA is a plan put forward by Pennsylvania House Republicans to support the natural gas industry in the state. It includes 7 bills, 4 of which have already advanced, including some that deal with redeveloping old industrial sites. Other proposals are more controversial, like a bill aimed at speeding up environmental permits that address, among other things, air and water pollution. The bill would take away permitting authority from the state's Department of Environmental Protection and give it to a new politically appointed commission. Stephen Caruso, the House reporter for the Pennsylvania Capital Star, explains.
The details are pretty sparse within the bill. The basics of it is it's a 5-person commission. It's made up of gubernatorial appointees. They'd have to be approved by the Senate. And then this commission would approve all permits. But even then, the whole process after that is not laid out in the bill. The bill just says that the natural gas industry is so concerned about permitting, and a lot of industries, when it comes to DEP, that we need to just uproot the system and completely change it. This could be, the commission votes on every single permit. This could be they hire a bunch of professionals to do it, kind of like what DEP has now. A lot of those details are kind of left unresolved, which is what is driving a lot of environmentalists, I mean, concerning them. The bill specifically says that DEP staff will not be transferred to this new commission. All funding related to permitting will go over there. So there's a lot of concern. I mean, you saw David Hess, who's a former DEP secretary under a Republican governor in the early 2000s, point out that you were kind of guaranteeing 2 years of delays because you either need to hire trained personnel like the ones we have at DEP, or you are going to need to train a whole bunch of staff to handle the permitting. And that means while they're training, who's going to be running permits?
Just to be clear, this commission would take over the permitting process from DEP and leave just enforcement to the Department of Environmental Protection.
Yeah. You know, Republicans will often point to it's a very long wait for permits. You know, you can sometimes see delays that go, you know, maybe a couple weeks, maybe even touch a month, maybe a little bit more than that. You know, so this is their attempt to try and, you know, address that.
We're talking about tens of thousands of permits a year. The Department of Environmental Protection's funding has been trimmed over the years. So why not just give the Department of Environmental Protection more money, more resources to do the job?
Mm-hmm. And you will find a lot of people who agree with that in the Capitol, Republicans and Democrats. There is a very large contingent of Southeastern Republicans who are just like, the problem is very simple. We want DEP to get more things done. Let's give them more money. They used to have a budget, I believe, in the early 2000s that touched into the maybe $300 million. They are now down to about, I think, $130, $150 million budget. It's been going down at the same time as natural gas industry is becoming, you know, bigger and bigger in the state. You know, Republicans, there's this one study that just came out that they were using a lot in the arguments for it from a state legislative research group that they found that looking at specifically two permitting programs in DEP, funding going up did not mean more permits coming out. So they've use this to extrapolate and say more funding isn't the solution. What's been kind of pointed out to me by environmental groups is that, you know, this is a study of two specific permits. DEP has lots of different permitting programs. Like, you know, the devil is in the details. That's kind of the way it's been set up by Republicans, that we just need to speed up the permitting process. So this is our best bet.
Stephen Caruso is the House reporter for the Pennsylvania Capital Star. He says that particular bill hasn't passed in the House, but Republicans hope they'll have more support when the House reconvenes on October 21st. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. An Allegheny County man is suing a Canonsburg company for rescinding a job offer after he failed a drug test. Derek Zell says because he's a legal holder of a medical marijuana card, Universal Electric Corporation's decision violates Pennsylvania's medical marijuana law. WESA health reporter Sarah Bowden's been following the story, and she joins us now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So what exactly is Zell's argument here?
Well, Zell says that there's a part of the Pennsylvania medical marijuana law statute that says no employer may discharge, threaten, refuse to hire, otherwise discriminate, or retaliate against an employee for their medical marijuana use. So he's saying that because that's exactly, he alleges that that's exactly what happened with Universal Electric. Universal Electric violated the law, and he's suing for $35,000 in damages.
Universal Electric saying anything?
They haven't gotten back to me with a comment yet, and this complaint was just filed, so I believe they haven't filed back.
Right, and it is typical that the recipient of a suit
Yes, this quiet. It isn't weird that they haven't gotten back to me.
How many cases like this has there ever been one since medical marijuana in Pennsylvania?
So there isn't a database through a lot of phone calls and Googling. I believe there is another one in Lackawanna County. And that's, I was told that from Zell's attorney who, through professional organizations, reached out. But this might be one of the, if not the only case of this kind.
Mm-hmm. I understand there's a Pittsburgh police officer who's on paid leave for the same thing.
Right. So he is on administrative leave. He is a medical marijuana user. He hasn't sued yet because he's on paid administrative leave. And I think it's interesting to note that medical marijuana, the law does not require employers to make accommodations for on-the-job use. Not that this officer or right. Mr. Zell was trying to use medical marijuana on the job, but I think that's an important part of the statute.
Mm-hmm. It's a new issue in Pennsylvania, but medical marijuana, of course, has been available in other states, including California, for some time. Have courts been handling similar cases elsewhere?
Yes, they have. And up until pretty recently, those courts have generally found in favor of the employer. Now, it's important to note that states like Oregon, which have medical marijuana and recreational marijuana, do not have specific language in their state statutes protecting people from employment discrimination when it comes to medical marijuana use. So I'm very curious to see what happens here in Pennsylvania. A Delaware court, for example, which does have language protecting people from medical marijuana, from discrimination for right. medical marijuana use, recently found in favor of the employee. So it's pretty interesting developing legal landscape here.
About 30 seconds left. Any idea what's going to happen next?
Nope. This could maybe go all the way to the Supreme Court. They could settle for $35,000. Who knows? But I think that it's very possible that if this case doesn't eventually end up in higher courts, another case from Pennsylvania likely will.
This could go to federal court, and of course, federal laws are different than state laws.
Yeah, there's a lot of conflict, obviously, because at federal level, medical marijuana or marijuana in general is a Schedule I substance, and it's illegal. So there's a lot of conflict there that needs to be worked out.
All right. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. We'll look forward to your continued reporting on this. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. When 9-to-5ers in downtown and the Strip District head home for the day, a quiet but mighty force of night shift employees start their workday in those same offices. And they're getting louder. About 1,500 unionized cleaners and janitors began negotiations with their employers last week, asking for, well, we'll let them tell you. Joining us in studio are Sam Williamson. He's the Western Pennsylvania District Leader for 32BJ at the SEIU. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And two cleaners who say their rights aren't being heard, Nakia Burton and Steve Kelly. Welcome to you both.
Hi,
hello.
Good morning.
How are you?
Nakia and Steve, I want to start with you. What do your work days look like? The hours are obviously different. What else? What do you do at night, Nakia?
Oh, clean a lot. Like, a lot. The biggest thing is, like, you never know what you're going to walk into because their building has parties and or people call off and now you have extra work to do. I do bathrooms right now. I do 10 floors of bathrooms. That's about 39 bathrooms in total. So it's a lot. And then when I get home, I'm extremely tired. But I got to stay up for an extra 2 hours to take my son to school, then prep lunch. So it's hectic, especially working overnight because now your biological clock is feeling weird.
Yeah. Steve, does that sound familiar to you?
Absolutely, it does. I clean up behind 373 people, behind 2.5 floors. That is an incredible amount of work, and you know the bosses always think I can do more, and I'm like, okay, are you gonna send some help over? And mm-hmm. they're always like, no. And then you have to juggle all of that. So
humans are just kind of nasty.
Yeah.
I've seen some things in my restrooms.
Well, and it's different too. If you don't live in a place, maybe you don't take care of it the same way you would if it were your own living room, right?
Well, the thing with the tenants, man, that always surprises me is that like anything that they put in their mouth or in their hands goes on the floor. Like, do you do that at home? I'm sure you don't. And if your kids were to do that, then you'd probably be like, pick that up. But not these folks. Whatever's in their hands, they just bloop right on the floor.
Well, and Sam, one of the things that SEIU is so focused on right now, there's such a noticeable difference in the wages among the cleaners that work in the Central Business District and cleaners that work in the Strip District. Tell us about the disparity and kind of what SEIU is trying to look at from a wider lens.
Sure. I also just want to pick up on one thing that Steve and Nakia touched on
yeah.
and just sort of put it in perspective for listeners out there. You know, 32BJ members keep this city running from the airport to our college campuses, to workplaces all across the city. Our members are the folks who are keeping buildings safe, keeping buildings clean, cooking for college students, and making sure that Pittsburgh actually feels like home across the city. And the average 30TBJ member in 1 8-hour shift is cleaning somewhere between 40 and 50,000 square feet of space. Think about the size of your house or your apartment. Imagine what your house or your apartment looks like after your kids have had a crazy birthday party or you've had a dinner party, and imagine doing that for 40 to 50,000 square feet every single night. Most people, it takes them several hours just to clean up their own house. Mm-hmm. Our members are doing 10, 15, 20 houses in a night, every single night. It's hard, difficult, physical work. And it's hard, difficult, physical work no matter what part of the city they're working in. And this is really the equity issue that you were asking about. This is now a pretty good job for a cleaner in downtown Pittsburgh. Our members make almost $18 an hour. They're full-time jobs. We have good health benefits, retirement security, and we're planning to build on all of that in these contract negotiations. But if you cross into the Strip District or take a bus up into Oakland or ride out to Bakery Square or over to the South Side, the parts of the city that are growing, where development is happening, where tech companies are moving, wages are dramatically lower. They're only making $13.80 an hour in those parts of the city. And that's just unsustainable. It's not fair. It's not right. It makes no sense based on the changes in our economy and where we're actually seeing growth and development happening in the city. And we're demanding in negotiations that our members who are cleaning up after companies like Google and Apple or Amazon or Argo AI actually share in some of the prosperity that is being generated by the transformations of the Pittsburgh economy.
How much does that identity of the companies that are contracting your members kind of play into your feelings around these negotiations and what they're able to contribute, whether it's through healthcare or just base salary?
We know that some of the richest companies in the world, quite frankly, can afford to ensure that the cleaners in their buildings are making living wages. But those are also the parts of the city, as I said, that are growing. There's about 1.3 million square feet of office space under construction right now in Pittsburgh. Most of it's in places like Oakland and the Strip District. You know, if a downtown cleaner can make a good living, can earn decent wages, then in parts of the city where the rent rates are almost double what they are in downtown Pittsburgh, we can achieve the same as a city.
Yeah. So often in Pittsburgh, when we think of a union fight, it's one organization with many workers. This is a little bit more complex. You're fighting for members who come from a variety of backgrounds and maybe work in a variety of different places, different companies. Does that complicate the process at all?
Yeah, we have 10 different companies that we're actually negotiating with all at the same time. They have a contractors association that most of them are members of, so that makes the process a little bit easier. But at the end of the day, you know, you can be a cleaner in an office building and work for a series of different companies over the course of your career there. And if you're in the union, your wages, your benefits, your seniority, your health insurance will stay the same no matter who the employer is. So having everybody at the table is part of what makes sure that these can be family sustaining jobs with security in the long run.
Nakia, you wrote an op-ed for the Post-Gazette this week about your experience. Can you tell us more about it? How has being a union member affected your life?
It literally changed my life a lot. So I'm a single mom. I originally worked for a fast food company for 4 years. Every couple of months, they do an edit where, you know, they'll see who's up for a manager role. And I exceeded our expectations. You know, have a 40-hour work week, come on time, get customer compliments on it, like online. And everybody loved me. I worked out of Bridgeville. I'm extremely goofy. If you ever meet me in person, I make everybody laugh. So, but they just kept passing me up over and over again. And I'm just like, what is the matter? Oh, well, now you need a car. So I'm like, I don't think I can afford a car. I'm making $7.50 an hour. They're like, well, you need to go and become a manager. So I got a car. That put me in a hole. And then they just kept passing me up. The last straw is when they hired a girl who was 19 years old and gave her the manager position of salary. I was like, you know what? It's a lot of nepotism going on here. I don't want to work here anymore. So I quit. During that time, my uncle works for the cleaning company. He's been in the union for 24 years. He's like, apply for where I work at. They ended up putting me on the north side, which was great. before that, I heard bad things about the union. Like, before growing up, like, oh, unions do this. They take your money. Don't do anything for you. So I'm like, really? So when I got into here, I was like, I was a little skeptical at first. But then I met a rep, and he was like, come see a rally. Come see how it is. I'm like, sure. I met Sam down there. Steve's been there for a while. And the rally was, like, it was a rush. I like to be goofy. I like to be loud. And the first day I came to rally, I played the drums just because, like, they're... It's like, well, sure, I'll get into it, whatever.
Yeah.
And that was extremely fun. So I started getting more and more involved with the union. Unfortunately, during that time, I became homeless with my son. And we started living in a car for about 2.5 months. And I didn't tell anybody because I'm like a very strong person. I was raised that way. But Sam let me talk to me, like, there's an upcoming brigade, Fight for 15 movement, and I think you'll really be good at it, so sign on. From that point, I was able to save enough money to go ahead and get my first apartment. And I've been picking up from there. Like, literally everything's improved. My son comes to everything with me involved in the union. He loves it. And it lets him see that it's good. It's okay to be a janitor. It lets him see it's okay to be a fast food worker. It's okay to be a security guard. It's not a stupid job. It's not a low class job either. It's a good job. If you take pride in it, it becomes even better.
It sounds like it's built a real sense of community. Steve, have you experienced the same?
Yeah. So I've been in the union for going on 10 years. But like before the union, my wife and I, we really, really struggled. And, you know, we both were working, and it was like 40-hour week, both of us. And we could never keep a roof over our heads. And we're talking about, like, you're paying $450 rent. But we could never keep a roof over our heads, and food was always an issue. One place that we lived in, we had to run an extension cord down to the basement so we could have lights. You know what I mean? Then when the landlord found out about that, he took the extension cord. So that got crazy, you know. And before I go any further, you know, for the listeners out there, a union is the fastest way for a poor man to get into the middle class. And I think that that is the reason why the powers that be don't like us, because we actually elevate those around us. And so anyway, there were times, man, where my wife and I would go like 2 or 3 days without eating anything but potatoes. We ate them every way. We boiled them, we mashed them, we fried them. It just was really crazy. And then somebody told me about the job that I'm at now. And I remember getting my first paycheck, and I looked at it. And like, I'm 53. I've never made anything more than $9 to $10 over my working career. And I looked at the paycheck, and it said $13.50. So I went in the boss's office, and I was like, did you make a mistake? And he looked at me and was like, no, you're in a union. So things got better so quickly for me and my wife. We really have, I mean, we haven't moved up to the top penthouse. Don't think that that's the case. But we no longer live in the conditions that we lived in.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, joined in studio by representatives of 32BJ. They're in negotiations with their employers for better wages and better benefits in their cleaning jobs downtown, in the Strip District, Bakery Square, and elsewhere. Sam, I'm curious. I know you're going to stand with state and local leaders later today, as well as your members at 15th and Railroad Street to protest some of these wage disparities. What are you hoping to hear from the companies themselves? Do you anticipate them being present at the rally?
So we're going to have a march through the Strip District and a rally at 15th and Railroad, as you mentioned, because we view that part of the city as emblematic of the disparity that we're pointing to. Hundreds of thousands of square feet of office space has been built just over the last couple of years, and hundreds of thousands of square feet more is under construction and being planned. And so we want to draw attention to the fact that the 32BJ members who are cleaning those buildings are not making enough money to survive. You know, we hope that the building owners and the contractors who we actually negotiate with we'll look at that and we'll listen to the stories of cleaners like Steve and Nakia and others across the city, and we'll hear what we're saying and agree that this is a disparity that doesn't make sense if we want to make sure that Pittsburgh is a livable city for everyone, if we want to ensure that the economic growth that we're seeing across the city actually does benefit everyone. You know, more than a third of these new office spaces are being taken up by tech companies. That's not the future of the Pittsburgh economy. That is the current Pittsburgh economy. And we're not going to have a sustainable, strong economy if we can't make sure that that growth and the development actually lifts up incomes at all levels of the economy.
Contracted workers at Google in Pittsburgh recently voted to unionize. In August, workers at Carnegie Library followed suit. Do you help each other work with other union organizations in the city? Do your members get a chance to talk to others about how to be involved, whether it's the Fight for 15 or other rallies across the city?
Oh, absolutely. We represent cleaners at the Carnegie Library. Actually, just 2 days ago, ratified a new contract that will raise their wages to close to $20 an hour over the course of the agreement. And our members at the library very much actively supported the Steelworkers campaign to organize librarians and library techs there. We're really excited that Google workers are organizing into a union for the first time. You know, I mean, it just goes to show that what Steve said is absolutely true. That workers across every sector of our economy are learning that if we want to make change, if we want to rebuild a middle class, if we really want an economy that's fair for everyone, we've got to have strong unions at the heart of it.
Nakia, you mentioned that you kind of got started in this movement by coming along and seeing how it works for others before you were personally involved in the fight. What does it mean to you to have others stand with you now as you're going into negotiations for yourself?
It's great, especially to see like the representatives of Pittsburgh. I wasn't really big on politics until I started working in the union and getting more involved in campaigns. But it's good to see them actually care about the middle class and the lower class people and not just about when it's election time. So that means a lot for them to stand with us.
Cleaners in Philadelphia's 32BJ reached a deal with their employers this week. Mm-hmm. Steve, does that bring you any optimism to see that this can be done even on the other side of the state?
Yes, it does. Knowing that Philadelphia Reach, that gives us more energy as we go in there to get what we want from them, to get what we deserve from them. Yes, it does.
It definitely boosted our morale. Like when I was at work, a lot of people were asking me, like, so what did Philly do? And I'm like, they reached an agreement. They conceded to us and we reached an agreement. So everybody's actually a little bit more amped up too right now because like if Philly did it and they were looking at a tough fight, everybody's a little more gung-ho for this upcoming rallies today, later on today, and also for bargaining starting on Monday.
Like, details of that agreement, we should say, have not been made public, but the union was fighting for similar terms.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And 32BJ has 175,000 members across 11 states. 75,000 of them are commercial office cleaners who will be in bargaining this fall up and down the East Coast from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia, but also into New York, New Jersey, the Washington, D.C. market. And we are one union, and if we have to have a fight, we'll have one fight in all of those markets.
The current agreement here in Pittsburgh expires at midnight on October 31st. Are you optimistic about coming to a new agreement before then?
Yes, I am, because I know that our members will fight hard for what they deserve, and we'll have the support of elected officials, and I hope building owners across the region who want to make sure that we get an agreement and want to make sure that we invest in the wages and benefits of our members.
And what happens if you don't reach an agreement by that October 31st
Shut
deadline?
Shut down.
We'll be on strike.
Yep.
There are 1,500 of us downtown. We'll just simply shut them down. They don't want to do that, man. They don't want to have to deal with that. So I have absolutely no fear going into this. We're going to win.
Sam Williamson is the Western Pennsylvania District Leader for SEIU's 32BJ office. And Nakia Burton and Steve Kelly are members of that union. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That was The Confluence's Megan Harris. Members of SEIU 32BJ will meet in the Strip District at 2:15 and march from 27th and Railroad Streets to 15th and Railroad to rally for a new contract. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, why are some defendants with mental illness spending weeks and months in jail waiting for treatment so they can be competent to stand trial? If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance from Julia Zenkovich. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.